I'd like to call this meeting to order of the January 6th Planning and Zoning Commission. Roll call, please.
Hauser.
Present.
Donaldson.
Present.
Miller. Absent. Wendt.
Present.
Feathers.
Here.
Steele. Smith.
Here.
We have some changes to the agenda tonight. Perhaps I should go over those changes before we approve it, or... Okay, so as we're looking at the agenda, we are going to table our approval of minutes because we don't have a quorum of people who were here at the last meeting, so we're going to table that one. We're going to move item 9.1, the CDP 101, up under new business, so it would be like 8A. And under our list of commissioners, we still have the old list, and so we're crossing those out and adding the new names. I believe that is the proposed changes to our agenda. Could I hear a motion to approve that?
I would move to approve the minutes as corrections have been made.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And as I stated, we're going to table the approval of minutes. So we will move on to public comment. This is the time for anyone who is here who does not wish to address the agenda items, who just wants to comment on something other than the scheduled agenda items. Now is the time for you to come to the microphone and have public comment. Do we have anyone who would wish to do such? Seeing none, we will go to item number 6, tabled business. No. Item number 7, old business. We have no old business. We will go to item number 8, new business, and start with the CDP 101.
What I hope to do is in 8 to 10 minutes or less, give you an overview of the CDP, the County Development Plan, for the commission members of the public. For the newer members, the old members will recall, last December when you adopted your calendar and provided input on our department's work program, you asked for an item to be included that talks about training on a quarterly basis for you all. This is that first in that quarterly training. We'll do that. I think we decided what the topics would be for each and every one, and the first one is the County Development Plan. Just a quick overview of what the presentation will be. I do want to just go briefly the history of land use plans and planning in Story County and how that sets the basis for some of the recommendations that you make today, and talk about the County Development Plan, and I will from this point forward say CDP. Implementation mechanisms that have been adopted by Story County, and then add a couple slides on the role of where you are built into this process, and then opportunity for question and answer. So what has been land use planning in Story County? I should have asked you before I brought that slide up. I don't know how many of you saw it. When do you think land use planning first started in Story County? I'll just not answer.
1957.
Yeah, actually it's been long. We celebrated our 50th anniversary a few years ago. 1957, the Zoning Commission at that time, is what you all were called, commissioned a study called the Story County, Iowa Zoning Study, one of the first in the state. We were not the first, but we were one of the first. This had three components, the land use study, comprehensive planning, and then a suggested zone plan, which then became the zoning map and the zoning ordinance. That then turned into the first zoning ordinance adopted on September 2nd, 1958 by the Board of Supervisors. Very strong in agricultural land preservation, which is a key theme that has carried forward since 1957. Solid history, and that's what it is rooted in. Then we get to 1977 with the planning documents that were adopted on June 30th of that year. Goes three components again, the Story County land use policy, again strong in agricultural land preservation, the zoning ordinance, and then in 1977 we adopted our first set of subdivision regulations. So we went 20 years with just zoning and the land use plan, and then added the subdivision chapter in 1977. Then we get to 1993 with the first county development plan. It was adopted in May of that year, again maintaining that goal of agricultural land preservation. If you read the 1993 goal, that's iterated several times throughout. It had a life of a plan set for a review to begin in 1998, which we did, and I'll get to. But this is when we first identified critical resource areas. In 1977 and through subsequent years, we established the Greenbelt Zone District. But in 1993 is when we first started planning for critical resource areas. So it gets us to where we are today with the CDP 101. What we are operating under today was first adopted in 2003. This is the update to the 1998 plan. We began the update in 1998, and it did take a full 5 years to update. What was originally thought to just be some tweaking took a whole different direction and approach. I will say that, though, that goal maintaining agricultural land persevered and was carried through. We did then adopt, but the board adopted the interim land use framework map, which is that image you see on the right, in 2003, along with the written county development plan. They amended it a couple years ago in 2011, and then in 2006 as well, when they added the Ames River Fringe Plan. The 2011 action was to remove the Lincoln Highway Corridor, and that's a whole can of worms that if you want to ask those questions later on, I'll address, but that's no longer incorporated into the plan. Just four chapters in the county development plan. I think you all have a copy in front of you. If you don't, we'll make sure you get one too. The chapter one is the basic introduction to the plan, what sets up the legal authority for it, looking at the state code. It addresses the nature and purpose of the county development plan. We have a horizon that looks out to 2020 in the plan. And make sure to mention that it is general in nature. That is not meant to be parcel specific, but be general in the approach, and as it says, outlines a desirable future development framework by showing the general location, character, and extent of physical development and the relationship of those elements. It is truly a land use plan, and it does address physical development in that standpoint. And chapter one also talks about the planning process. We brought a couple consultants in, had a citizen steering committee that oversaw this. It was a very long 5 years, but the product, it was a different paradigm shift from the 1993 document in lots of regards. Chapter two is really the heart and soul, the vision and goals of the plan. The vision is in the right, that box, but really quality of life assets that were identified in the vision, a rural small town lifestyle with easy access to urban amenities, crime-free, congestion-free community where hardworking residents have access to good jobs, good schools, and good housing, abundant, accessible, clean air and water, and productive, fertile soil, and the honest, accessible, and responsible public officials who facilitate the planned orderly growth and development of the county. And so overarching over the goal. There are four prime goals of the county development plan. I'm going to just read the prime goals, and you can read the bullets on your own. The first and foremost, protect and preserve Story County's agricultural resources. Next, protect and preserve Story County's natural resources. Promote and improve the mobility of Story County residents. And then foster cooperation and collaboration between rural and urban residents and public and private enterprises that enhances the quality of life assets in Story County. Chapter 3 then takes the vision and goals and breaks it down to principles and objectives, like you see on the image on the right. This ties then to the future land use map, which to this day is still called interim. It was specifically chosen to be called interim by the Citizens Advisory Committee and ultimately recommended by the Commission and approved by the Board of Supervisors until we got that fourth bullet point down there, finalized the cooperative planning areas. So I go back to that map. You see the bubbles around each of the communities, and around Ames, those don't exist. Around Ames, we've done the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. We've delineated what the land uses are within 2 miles of the city of Ames. For all the other communities, we have a cooperative planning area, Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3, with the idea that the densification is greater in that Tier 1 in closer proximity to the city limits, and then becomes more rural as you go into that Tier 3, and then everything outside of that is an agricultural conservation area. The idea set forth in the plan is that we would, within a couple years, have all these fringe area plans completed around each community, but Ames Urban Fringe Plan took 5+ years to complete, so we're hoping that we will get that accomplished, but it's still called interim for that very reason. We do have 6 categories of land uses: the agricultural conservation area, the natural resource area, transportation system, cooperative planning areas, rural residential areas, and mixed use areas. Rural residential areas are those areas of existing subdivisions that have already been platted and brought online prior to the adoption of this plan. Mixed use areas are those unincorporated towns, Iowa Center, Fernald, Shipley, that do have a great mix of uses and would like to further that and plan for that. Then Chapter 4 gets into how we make this work, the plan implementation. It envisions area and project-specific evaluation and review. And then does set forth an action plan on the very final pages. And a lot of those projects have not come to fruition. I'll look at the 5-year or the master transportation plan. It's something that, it's been slow to evolve. I think we're seeing evolution now come forward, and a lot of changes have occurred at Story County that a lot of the ideas initially thought and put forth in the county and development plan will come and be finalized in the next couple of years. So, with that, I wanted to a couple slides on the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, because the Ames Urban Fringe Plan is now an adopted component of the county development plan. The Ames Urban Fringe Plan detailed land uses have replaced that cooperative planning area Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3 around the city of Ames. It's a joint planning effort that, believe it or not, started in 1998, about the same time that, actually 1999, sorry, that we started the, shortly about the same time we started the update of the county development plan. It took us a great number of years, but we officially adopted the joint plan in 2006. It's adopted by the City of Ames, City of Gilbert, and Story County. Boone County has agreed to the principles in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, the guiding principles. There is an adopted intergovernmental agreement, or we call a 28E agreement. Chapter 28E of the Code of Iowa allows for jurisdictions in the state to enter into multi-jurisdictional agreements. And that is the mechanism that Story County, Gilbert, and Ames have used to implement the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. And I think I gave you all a copy of that, too. So when you have staff reports that talk about the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, know that's a component of the County Development Plan, which staff does usually detail in our staff reports. And when we reference the intergovernmental agreement, keep in mind that's the tool that Story County uses to implement then the Ames River Fringe Plan. Any questions thus far? I'm telling you, it's a 101. We'll have to have more in-depth. The implementation mechanisms then. I've already talked about the 28E agreement. We also have the Story County, Iowa Code of Ordinances. This is a black book that we don't expect any of you ever to carry around. In fact, we don't give you a copy. It's online, and we also, in our staff reports, either reference an appendix or we build the applicable standards right into the language of the staff report. But the vast majority of the Code of Ordinances, half of it, is defined for our purposes for property and land use. From everything from Chapter 80, which is the floodplain management program, down to Chapter 93, which addresses the mechanism we use for infractions. So the county development plan sets the stage and the foundation for the implementation measures we've now defined through our Code of Ordinances. And I've already said we have the intergovernmental agreement. We also have one with the City of Nevada, too. And that has been longstanding. That's been in place since the early 90s. And we've not yet revisited that. When we get to the point that we're completing that fringe area agreement with the City of Nevada, we'll revisit that as well. But it's still holding up and meeting a test of time, so that's referenced now and then. So what is your role? You are both policy development and policy application responsibilities, and we bring subdivisions, rezonings, plan amendments, conditional use permits to you for recommendation to the Board of Adjustment or the Board of Supervisors. We also ask that you give us advice on things that you think that need to be amended or changed, or trends that you sense that Story County is experiencing that you want staff and the Board of Supervisors to donate attention and time and effort toward. That is really, as both Planning and Zoning Commission, your role, the advisory function. And again, you are that recommending body, the ability for the public to come and have an opportunity to express concerns and then forward those on to the respective decision makers. And I'm very pleased you do have a full Planning and Zoning Commission as of January 2014. It's been a while since we've had a 7-member commission, and it's very we're very happy from staff's perspective. What I did, I went over the history. I gave you the 101, the County Development Plan, told you how we implement it and the role, and then we'll see questions. One thing I do want to make sure you know, resources. Well, at all times, if you want a copy of any of these, if you don't have one, we'll get you one, excluding the regulations, because those are available online. If you do want a written copy, we can get you that too. But there's a lot of things that you really might not need, unless you're just one person that enjoys reading code. And if you are, God bless you, but that's great, but these are the four primary things we do deal with. I did not put the Nevada 20E agreement up there. That's whenever we do deal with that, we give you the references. Questions, and I'll try to supply answers.
Yeah, and you said that some of those references, like the CDP and things, those are or will be available online?
They'll be available online. As soon as the Ames River Fringe Plan, the agreement, you can Google, or it's on the Ames website. The land use regulations are on our website, storycountyiowa.gov, under Planning and Development, and then Development Regulations. We just need to get the County Development Plan up there. And as soon as that's successfully up there, we'll send you a link.
With the county development plan and the areas around the towns, that's supposed to be a collaborative effort between you folks and the council of each town, and so each town council is, some are more enthused than others to move forward with it, I assume.
Some have just said you do the work and we'll respond. Some have wanted to work with us, but our efforts have not been 100%. We've been, the plan with the Ames took so long, and then actually the agreement took long as well, So that is where our efforts were, from a planning standpoint, were directed. Our work program for next calendar, or this, we're 2014. Our 2014 calendar work program has us looking at a comprehensive plan for Story County. First and foremost in that would be the completion of those fringe area agreements. I have our department's work budget work session this coming Wednesday morning. I've asked for funding to bring a consultant in to do that, because even with 3.5 staff members with other responsibilities, completing that effort is a great undertaking. It's doable from staff's end, but it would be better done if we could bring a consultant on. And I don't know how those discussions will go.
Questions? Thank you, Leanne. Regarding case number CUP09-13, Rolling Hills Conditional Use Permit. Staff, please present your report.
1 minute to switch over. Take mine out. Okay.
Okay, good evening. Again, this is regarding CUP 09-13, also known as the Rolling Hills Conditional Use Permit Request, of the property owner Lino's Property Incorporated, property located in Section 2280 Creek Township, the Rolling Hills Mobile Home Park, which is located approximately 1/4 mile north of the city of Maxwell, there along 653rd Avenue. The total size of the area is 33.11 gross acres, two parcels in that mobile home park. The conditional use permit area is a little over 3 acres. Current zoning of that property is residential mobile home park, and it's currently being used again as Rolling Hills mobile home park. Here you can see the surrounding property owner map that was mailed to all property owners within 2 miles of the subject property, which is there highlighted in red. The areas highlighted in blue are all the property owners that were in 1/4 mile that were all notified via mail. This is a zoom in of the actual conditional use permit area. Kind of hard to see. Maybe I can get the. Can never get this thing to go, but. You can see right there lots 4, 5, 6, and 7, kind of in the middle, just to the north of the drive there. That's the main area, and then all the vacant area to the north of those four actual lots, pretty much in the entire viewable area that's highlighted in blue, is the conditional use permit area. The request is to allow for a conditional use permit to allow for commercial campground in addition to the mobile home park on the property. According to the applicant, the campground will consist of 8 lots and will be located on the north side of the property as I just exhibited to you. They have received numerous inquiries from construction workers with the new ethanol plant that's being placed here to the west of town to park their travel trailers on site while they are in town during construction. And it should be noted that the current zoning doesn't allow for parking of campers or travel trailers on the mobile home park site. So this would allow for that. When we're looking at conditional use permit standards of approval, we're looking at these following. One is compatibility. Is the proposed use compatible with surrounding land uses? Transition, does the proposed use provide suitable buffers between that use and surrounding land uses that may or may not be compatible? Does it provide adequate ingress and egress? Are there any traffic issues associated with the request? Does it provide sufficient parking and loading? Are the signs and lighting that are proposed with the use incongruent with Story County regulations? And finally, does the request help protect environmental resources? Further, that if the Board of Adjustment concludes that all these have been met, they must approve it unless they find that there's strong probability that the proposal will not adequately safeguard the health, safety, and general welfare of persons residing or working in adjoining or surrounding property, or impair an adequate supply of light and air to surrounding property, or unduly increase congestion in roads, or hazard from fire, flood, or similar dangers, or diminish or repair established property values on adjoining or surrounding property, or not be in accord with the intent, purpose, and spirit of the ordinance and the county development plan. Looking at those standards of approval specifically, staff noted that there's a residential parcel to the north of the proposed camping area, the dwelling of which is located approximately 900 feet to the campground site. The applicant in their application proposed plantings for use as a buffer if deemed necessary by the county. Ingress and egress is already provided through the mobile home park. Each one of the spots, each one of the lots that are on the mobile home park contains enough parking for at least two vehicles, depending on the size of the camping trailer. Signage and permitted safety lighting is already provided through the mobile home park, and the proposed use is very similar to the use already allowed on the property. In addition to those standards of approval that go with all conditional use permit requests, we also have supplemental standards pertaining to commercial campgrounds and travel trailer parks. Those are that first, that the minimum area is at least 2 net acres, and the maximum density is 20 unit spaces per gross acre of park site, that the drives for the campground are at least 18 feet of width, if one-way, or 25 feet in width two-way, and provided with a smooth, hard, dense surface that shall be durable and well-drained under normal use of conditions. Rear and or side yards shall be screened from adjacent property by planting screen not less than 10 feet in width, 6 feet in height, or by fence, wall, berm, or comparable means. There may be a common facility service building that provide laundry facilities, sanitary facilities, rec facilities, non-automotive commercial uses, etc. Also, park management buildings, community buildings, one dwelling unit to become occupied by the owner administrator, and other uses of a similar nature. All such buildings shall be located within the Central Park area and shall be primarily for the use of the park occupants, and at least one parking space for and within the area of each unit space, and that each spot has an E911 address posted in accordance with the requirements of our ordinance. Looking at those standards of approval, staff found that A and B are met through the proposal. That, as I stated at the beginning, the conditional use permit area is over 2 net acres, a little over 3. There are no additional drives proposed in addition to the ones that already exist in the mobile home park. There's no specific screening on the north side of the property that they have proposed specifically to meet that specific standard of the screening. Just a mention of possible plantings, but no specifics thereof. There's already a common services building in the manager's building on the northeast side of the property. And staff also noted that E911 addresses will need to be attained for each space as they're created, as the mobile home park currently does not have specific E911 addresses for each lot. Notification letters were mailed to surrounding property owners regarding the subject hearing on December 27th, and legal notifications were published on December 26th. We did not receive any specific comments from the public, mostly just questions, nothing formal. I did receive several phone calls. We did on Friday receive a copy of a proposed resolution from the City of Maxwell. I believe Kristen provided each of you with a copy of that. They are actually meeting this evening at 7 in the next hour, and that will be on their agenda to either approve or not that proposed resolution. Just kind of paraphrasing, that they support the need for the use, but proposes a reasonable time frame during which the campsites will be permitted. Again, as they identified that the current need is for itinerant workers coming in, and that may be a temporary sort of thing. So wanted to add that in, as we got that on Friday after I already drafted the staff report. Looking at possible conditions that Planning and Zoning Commission may recommend being placed on the proposal. Given that there hasn't been any specific mention of access drives to that area of the north of the four existing lots that are proposed, staff is recommending that possibly a way around that would be to limit the number of lots to the four existing lots in the mobile home park, and that additional lots may be added through modification when adequate access drives and screening plans are provided to the vacant area to the north of the mobile home park. Additionally, staff feels that might create more of a buffer that's actually already in place with the current mobile home park of that vacant north area and the surrounding residential parcel to the north of that property. And that further, again, just formalizing it that E911 addresses shall be obtained for each lot prior to the issuance of a conditional use permit. And with that, I leave you with the following four alternatives and be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Does anyone have questions for Ryan?
Yeah, Ryan, they don't operate with a 911 address. It would just be lot numbers.
Right.
I mean, it's 31100 653rd Avenue is the is the address, and they just go by lot numbers after that for identification if there was a fire call or an ambulance call. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. I'm not sure the exact history of it. I'm sure my guess is that the mobile home park was in place prior to when
right,
we acquired
that
E911.
So because of that, there wasn't a requirement for them to come up with, if it was adequate, or deemed adequate at the time, that we just go with that base address, because there is this, the main one, primary entrance there.
Yep.
And then find a lot, you know, go left or go straight when you go in the driveway.
Yep. And sometimes it is, you know, I go in there quite often for inspections and whatnot, and sometimes it is difficult to locate each one, but they're currently in. You know, conformance with our regulations, the E911 regulations. However, given that this is a new proposal in addition to what is currently allowed through their grandfathered zoning,
right.
They would have to get E911 addresses for the travel trailer lots.
Just for those?
Yes.
So if you currently lived in lot 14, you would still be that address for lot 14.
Correct.
Okay, so you'd have to put a little blue sign up just where the travel trailer lots are.
In order to be in conformance with our ordinance.
Okay. To me, it makes more sense either leave them as they are or put them on all of them. But
I'm not sure if it would be appropriate to waive that standard, given that it does seem kind of out of place. But on the staff level, we hadn't discussed that.
someone were to propose a new campground from scratch, not kind of housed inside an existing mobile home park, would they be required to address each site in that campground with an E911 sign?
Yeah. Yeah, like if they were coming through with a 50-lot campground, each one.
Recreational campground.
Yeah, I believe, I could be wrong, but the campground that's in between here and along Highway 30 there, Twin Acres, I believe each one of those lots have their own E911 address. And that's a commercial campground.
Would this proposal allow just trailer camping or tent camping as well?
I would have to look up the definition. I do not recall.
Okay, maybe that's a question for the applicant. Let's suppose that it is just trailer camping or RV camping. Would they be required to connect somehow to the lagoon system?
Yeah, they would, and that's one of the reasons why this is a interesting idea for them, is that they already have those vacant lots and they already have sewer hookups and electrical hookups already available on those vacant lots, so they're ready to go.
So making a dump station unnecessary, for example, then, or
yeah, exactly. They already have the system in place. They however do not have that on that vacant area to the north, which might be another reason why we recommended not including that currently.
Might have said this in your presentation, but with the 8 lots that they're proposing, would on a whole the trailer park, the mobile home park, stay under the maximum density of lots per, what is it, 20?
Oh, not if we were to include the entire mobile home park, or?
Right, I mean, this is technically an extension of the existing mobile home park, so which has a maximum density, and they're proposing an increase of lots, in essence.
Well, what we're doing in this case is we're identifying that specific area as a conditional use permit area. So for purposes of the analysis of that density requirement, we're just looking at that 3-acre area that we identified to be the conditional use permit area, which would be the, you know, where the campground would be able to be located.
Thank you.
As far as the resolution from the city of Maxwell, did you actually speak to anyone from the?
I just received an email from Mayor Gast.
Okay. So you really don't know what they were thinking, like a 1 year, 5 year. You just really.
They just stated in the resolution that they were deferring to the judgment of the board in that case.
I'm certain of how many years it's going to take to finish that project. I think there's still probably a couple of years left. I know my mother owns a home that the tenant is working on that. He's just going to be there for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on the project out here.
And speaking with Leanne today about that very question, she mentioned that generally they're looking at a year from now at their earliest. But, yeah, it's up in the air talking about construction.
I was a little unclear as the screening requirement. Are you asking that be waived, or are the trees to the residents to the north to screen the?
No. That's still a standard of approval. But that possibly a way to ameliorate that. Currently. You can place 4 mobile homes right in those vacant lots with no buffer requirement. What I'm thinking of when I'm writing a staff report is how to kind of bring the proposal together and kind of meld it with our ordinance in a way. Again, that currently there's no buffer there, and so it would be up to you to to decide if a further condition of approval would be prudent, or you feel that it, even with that, it doesn't meet the standard.
My question, I guess, is looking at the code there, the section, was it 9.10.1d that you kind of highlighted there, where it talks about the screenings.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right to understand that it currently should have screening there under the current, you know, maybe not when it was originally approved or whatever, but...
That screening requirement is just for a commercial campground and travel trailer park. It's not for a mobile home park.
Okay.
I'm making a distinction there.
All right.
Yeah.
So, one of the options that's available then is to go ahead and approve it, but without the expansion into the undeveloped area, thereby waiving the screening and suggesting use the half of what the request is. So if the request is for 8 lots, use existing 4 developed lots and not do the screening, and then if additional space is needed, we can move forward with an additional amendment. But then that would likely require screening and other things. Is that
correct?
What I'm getting.
Are there further questions? Is the applicant present tonight, Jose Lanos? Would you like to present your case? Please come to the podium and use the microphone. Please state your name and address.
Michelle Galantine, 31100 653rd Avenue, lot number 77. I'm the on-site manager for the park. What we're proposing is to take 4 existing mobile home lots and make it 8 lots for campers. So put 2 campers per mobile home lot. They can both jump into the same existing sewage tee off of the water. We've had numerous requests for this from people working at the ethanol plant, and we're just trying to fill a void. We've had tenants ask for their parents that live in Texas. They want to come up and visit. They want to stay next to their kids. This is just something that we thought that since the lots are not being used right now for mobile homes, it is a way to bring revenue in and help the community. With the shortage of, do you realize how short there is of places for these campers, for these people that live and work out of town? There's one gentleman that's coming all the way from Alabama that wants to know if he can come and stay because he has a camper and he doesn't know where else he can go. I've recommended Twin Acres I don't know how many times to people. And it's just a very short, there's a shortage of places they can park.
Well, to me, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, to be able to utilize an existing infrastructure there, and like I say, it's beneficial to the ownership for, you know, for revenue, and so. But you're looking at putting 2 campers on per parking pad where the sites were. So you're only looking at going with 8, or you would. Okay. So,
5, 6, these are already removed.
Right. Is there still 1 and 2? I thought 2 was empty as well.
2 was empty.
But you're not going to put 1 there.
No, okay. We're just using the 4 lots that are together.
Okay, just the fours that are next adjacent. So, okay, that makes more sense. I like that.
To keep them all together.
Sure.
Rather than intermingle them throughout the whole park.
Okay.
Not that we don't want
to. Right, you're limited to eight people or eight campers, depending on who's staying in the campers.
Okay. And there's adequate room to put. I haven't been out there yet. I'm new here. But there's adequate room to put two per pad.
Yes.
Each one of those lots, just to note, those are 50 by 90 lots.
Have you heard of an estimate on how many years this might be for?
No. We just figure it's a way to bring in revenue to purchase new mobile homes. We're set up for 129 mobile homes, and we're only at 53 now. We have plenty of expansion. It's just bringing in the revenue to be able to purchase new mobile homes without having to take out loans as a small business.
May step down. If there's any public comment tonight towards this issue, please come to the podium and state your name and address. Seeing none, I would entertain a motion.
I would move that we recommend this with conditional approval as per the first line, I guess you would say, there, with the 911 addresses being the condition, and that this be for a maximum of 2 years from the date that it's approved by the Board of Supervisors, and that's just, you know, that's not set in stone because supervisors and adjustment can change that. Is that correct, Charlie? Or not Charlie? Ryan?
Yeah.
Do I hear, have a second?
I second.
Is there any further discussion or questions on this issue?
Yeah. I guess I'm wondering, you know, if we're approving a campground according to the regulations, then I'm not certain why we would want to put a time frame on it. What's the typical life of a CUP? Does it ever expire?
It expires in 5 years if no substantial action has been taken place towards the conditional use permit request.
Okay, but if it's active, if it's being used as granted, it automatically renews.
Yep.
On a regular basis.
Unless we find that they're not operating in conformance with the conditional use permit, then we can take action to expire it.
So an alternative to kind of deal with the concerns from the city is perhaps doing an annual review of the conditional use permit, or every 2 years a review of the conditional use permit.
Yeah, we have that.
I just don't, you know, I understand that the demand may be temporary, but to me that's for the property owners to decide whether the demand justifies them continuing to supply the lots. If we're going to approve a campground, then let's approve a campground and let them decide when and if to stop doing it, as long as they're doing it in compliance with any conditions we would provide, and perhaps set an annual review or a biannual review.
I guess my only reason in putting that in there is because of the recommendation of the mayor of Maxwell, I kind of slipped my mind when I made that if people were to come visit family members and want to park their camper there, they'd have to do it within the next 2 years, unless, you know, so they could come back and reapply, I guess, and we could change this, but that was my thought on this, and, you know, whether the supervisors stay with our recommendation or they throw that time out, that's up to them. This is just kind of for us to put an idea onto it. But
is there anything that would keep them from applying to renew the permit after the 2 years if we put that limit on it, or if the Board of Adjustment ultimately put that limit on it?
I'm not sure if there's precedent for expiring a permit automatically. I mean, perhaps Leanne can correct me. Normally what we do is we review them. Thinking of one specific case, we reviewed it after 5 years and to look at it at that time if it should expire. So there's precedent for that, to review it after a certain time, decide at that date, at that meeting, if it should expire or not. But I don't know if there's precedent for permit to actually just expire automatically. But we do the annual review. I can think of three cases offhand that we do annual reviews for currently.
And the current project is creating the demand. It's just the project today. Well, what if there's another project 2 years from now in a completely different place? You know,
or if it takes longer, construction delays. I guess my other comment in line with that is, we could go the other way of saying it's still limited to those, four specific lots for an indefinite period of time, but then stipulate the requirement of meeting the campground code of putting in a screen to the north, right? I mean, kind of two options. One is limited use or a limited time frame, not meeting the campground requirements, or an indefinite period of time within the lot restriction, but meet the campground requirements and put a screen in for the house to the north or the other area.
I would rescind my motion with the timetable listed onto it. So I would rescind the motion. To know my parliamentary procedure correctly, I'm not sure I can't amend it until we've actually voted approved it, correct?
You can amend the motion.
You can amend the motion, okay.
But not seconded can agree as a friendly amendment.
Okay, as a friendly amendment.
Yeah. Just before you do that, just what Ryan was saying, the only conditional use permit that we can recall that has a time frame is the pallet materials on 30 and 35 has a 35-year time frame for the conditional use permit. And generally, like Ryan said, we put, or the Board of Adjustment has put an annual review or biannual review, but not a duration per se.
Would you like to restate the motion?
Yeah, I would restate the motion as conditional use of those four lots, but not having any time restrictions upon that. That they would use the lots 4, 5, 6, and 7. And I'm gonna make that part of our motion. Never mind. That's the motion. You understand me? My wife can't, but can you?
I'll do my best.
Okay.
We have a second on that one.
I can second that one as well. I agree with what he said about taking it off the time restriction, so I second it.
So all those in favor, say aye.
We'll take roll call.
We'll do a roll call.
Brothers?
Aye.
Donaldson?
Aye.
Cowser?
Aye.
Steele?
Aye.
Wendt?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you. We'll move on to item 8.2. Subdivision 12-13, Cameron Estates Subdivision. Staff, please present your report.
Good evening. As you mentioned, this is case number SUB 12-13. It's the Cameron Estates Subdivision. Property owner on this property is Cameron Farms, LLC. Looking at the property location, you're looking at approximately 70 acres of land, which is north of Cameron School Road, east of 505th Avenue, and south of West 190th Street. Again, the size of the amendment area, 68.28 gross acres. I shouldn't say amendment area. This is a slide carried over from the rezoning last month, but that should be the size of the subdivision area, 68.28 gross, and then 65.59 net acres. Current zoning as of today on this property is A1 agricultural. However, AR, agricultural residential zoning, is pending on this property as the three veteran commissioners will recall. Last month, we did have a rezoning case come forward to the Planning and Zoning Commission on this property. That is moving forward to the Board of Supervisors tomorrow for first consideration, assuming that the Board of Supervisors would adopt the commission's recommendation, that would be approved, and we'd be looking at a final approval or our final official AR zoning on this property sometime within the next month or so. So we're treating it as it is an AR zone property for matters of the commission this evening, just assuming again that that's going to go forward, but as of today it is A1 agriculture. So hopefully I haven't confused you too much there. But the current land use on the property is classified as an agricultural use. It has been in row crop production for a good number of years. Looking at the land use framework designation, it's under the Andrew River Fringe Plan, which is a component of the county development plan. It is designated as rural residential, which is a subcategory of the rural service and ag conservation areas. It does include a little bit of natural areas on the property as well. Looking at this request, it's a major subdivision. It's taking two parcels, subdividing it into 47 lots, three outlots, one street lot, and again, that's in the AR, Agricultural Residential Zoning District. The outlots are mainly going to be dedicated as open space. The street lot will obviously be for the streets, and then the 47 lots, those will be residential lots. Looking at siting consideration, this is the preliminary subdivision plat. The Planning and Zoning Commission does provide a recommendation only on the preliminary plat to the Board of Supervisors. When the final plats come through, those will go straight to the Board of Supervisors and will not carry a recommendation with them. And looking even more in depth on this one, the City of Ames has waived their jurisdiction over the subdivision plat according to the adopted 2080 agreement between the City of Ames, the City of Gilbert, and Surrey County. This shows you the general location of the property here, and this was the SPO map that was mailed out to surrounding property owners. And I just had this working. You got Cameron School Road to the south here, 505th, bends over, and then West 190th right there. Again, that hashed area will be the subdivided area. This one here kind of shows you the lot arrangement, and I believe these packets were mailed out to you, so hopefully you've had a chance to kind of look at that, but again, shows the new streets here in yellow. These outlots would be the green areas through here, and then all 47 residential lots within there. And I'll break that down a little bit further here with some of the commentary we have. Going through, again, the staff report did outline all the applicable regulations to this subdivision. I'm not going to list them on the screen here because we'd probably be here for the next hour just going over regulations. But what I'm going to do is I'll just kind of summarize the analysis that we put in the staff report, mainly just going to point out a few of the more important factors of the subdivision and then some of the areas of concern that we had. First of all, going into the submittal requirements, there were no easements shown on the subdivision plat or no existing easement documentation provided. We're assuming that there are no really easements proposed at this time. However, we did note in the subdivision that the platting regulations require 10-foot public utility easements to be dedicated. Those weren't shown on the plat and should be. Those 10-foot easements can either be shown, I believe, on the side or the rears of the property lines. So that's going to fit in within the setbacks of the requirements on the lots anyways. But again, it is something that should be shown at least on the final plat. And I'm not sure to the accuracy of this. We do have some GIS data from Xenia that they provided a few years ago that shows that there is a water line on the west and north ends of this property. I'm not sure how that is put in there, if there's an easement on there, but nonetheless, we were just kind of wanting that to be shown on the subdivision plat, and if there is an easement associated with that, show where that easement is. We did make a note that we hadn't received covenants, but I did receive those covenants via email this morning from the applicant, and we'll get those reviewed prior to the next scheduled meeting, either if it's with the commission, if it gets delayed here, or if we go to the Board of Supervisors, yeah, we'll have it reviewed before that meeting and have some comments on there. I just did not have time to get that done today. The applicant has indicated that letters from Xenia Rural Water, Midland Power, Alliant Energy, which provides gas to the area, and from the West Story Fire Chief have all been requested, but those have not yet been received. And again, once those are received, we'll file that with the file. And I think the only comment we made was, this being a preliminary plat, I think staff would be comfortable in knowing that those are at least received before this preliminary plat gets final approval. Just so we know that the utility infrastructure is out there and available to this residential, our proposed residential area. The subdivision does include dedication of three new public roads. The primary street in the subdivision is named Cindy Lane, and that will provide access to the site from Cameron School Road up to 505th Avenue. We did note that there is a misspelling on the plat. Cindy Lane is misspelled. It is shown as C-I-S-B-Y. That's towards the north end of the plat where it meets 505th Avenue. We also noted that Cameron School Road, that's an existing paved county road, at this time it is estimated to carry approximately 2,210 vehicles per day, and then 505th Avenue, which is the existing gravel road, that carries approximately 80 vehicles per day. So assuming with this subdivision, I think the rule of thumb we've always gone by is that for each new lot, you can almost add 10 vehicle trips per day. So with 43 lots, you're looking at approximately, it could be an additional 4,300 vehicles per, or excuse me, 430 vehicles per day added to those numbers with this subdivision. The other new roads, one will be Sarah Lane, that does provide access from 505th up into the new primary Cindy Lane, and then Kelly Circle, which is a cul-de-sac, and that does provide access from Cindy Lane. We did note that there are not any conflicts with those names at that time. Another addition I would make to that is in talking with the applicant this morning, those names at this time were kind of used as placeholders, and they did let us know that they're, before final plat comes through, those names may change. But from a staff standpoint, as long as we're able to review those names before they come through and just make sure there's no conflict with any other road names in the county, that really wouldn't be a huge issue. But for purposes of review at this time, we'll stick with those names if there's any questions on them. And again, I'll just show you where those roads are. This is Cindy Lane that goes kind of up here. This is that Kelly Circle cul-de-sac you can see there. And this is Sarah Lane that comes for 505th up into that area. All new roads that are proposed, they do provide for a 50-foot road right-of-way with a 22-foot roadway and 4-foot shoulder. And assuming with the 4-foot shoulders that are required by code, that would provide for 10-foot ditches. Kelly Circle does provide access for up to 7 lots and is approximately 670 feet in length. The circular portion of that cul-de-sac will have a 65-foot radius right-of-way, which is what code does require, with a 45-foot radius paved portion. Again, that is the minimum that is required by Surrey County Code. In all, the street lots, which is the total right-of-way, will consume about 8% of this total site. Code also does require that 60 feet of right-of-way from the center line of the existing road shall be deeded to the county for future potential improvements. However, that right-of-way width may be modified with the approval of the county engineer. So those existing roads that we'd be looking at are 190th, 505th, and Cameron School Road. This plat only dedicates 50 feet, which amount was recommended by the county engineer, Darren Moon, in an email that was dated November 19th of 2013. That was due to the flat terrain and shallow ditches, that he felt 50 feet was more than necessary for this proposal, and that is what they are showing on the plat. Looking at the plat, proposed lot 9, by our definition, we would consider to be a flag lot. And flag lots, according to our code, shall be avoided wherever possible. In staff's opinion, it appears that lots 8 and 9 could be rearranged probably to avoid the use of a flag lot.
We didn't have really any documentation provided by the applicant to show that they needed a flag lot there. So if they could, we would prefer that those be rearranged and to avoid the flag lot if possible. We also noted that setback lines shall be shown on all the lots intended for residential development. Again, this plat does not show any of those setback lines. Looking at lot 44, we did note that that does not meet the required 1 acre minimum net density of the AR zone district. It's very close. 1 acre is about 43,560 square feet. Lot 44 is actually 43,488 square feet. So it's approximately 72 square feet short of what it needs to be. We did note that lot 43 to the north is 1.04 acres. Lot 45 to the south is 1.01 acres. So again, shifting lot lines somewhere between those three lots, you could easily get the three lots there to meet that 1 acre minimum lot size requirement. Lastly, on the lot, there are two proposed lots that propose to use a shared access easement. Those provide access for lots 21, 22, and then 23 and 24, and that's off 505th Avenue. You'll notice in our code that we do have a spacing requirement for driveways of 300 feet. When you get down to small residential lots like these, it's hard to meet that 300 feet. So again, you have to start being creative and using the shared access easements, and that's what this lot does show. We did want to note that those shared access easements, when they're actually shown on the final plat and the documentation provided, that they shall be parallel to the front lot line and shall not exceed 50 feet in width. And just kind of a breakdown of those last few areas that I've shown you. These are the shared access easements right here that I just went over for 23, 24, 21, and 22, and that's off 505th Avenue here. And this is the area kind of here. The flag lot on lot 9, you can kind of see where this 35-foot wide kind of finger comes down to the road right here, back into the larger lot there. And this is where I was kind of saying between lot 8 and 9, you would think that they could probably rearrange that arrangement there to avoid that use of the flag lot there. And then lot 44, you can see with the just the tad below the 1 acre minimum here, and then the 1.01 acres on 45 and the 1.04 acres on 43. Again, you can probably adjust those around a little bit just to make sure we meet those 1 acre minimums on each lot. Looking at the common open space with the subdivision, it does include 8.8 acres of outlots, which is approximately 13% of the subdivision. Surrey County requires 15% of the proposed residential subdivisions of 10 lots or more be dedicated for common open space. We did note that 15% of the proposed subdivision would be approximately 10.24 acres, and this proposed subdivision falls approximately 1.3 acres short of that number. We did note that alternative compliance is an option with proposed subdivisions. However, the applicant has not proposed any. In talking with the applicant today, they did note that they calculated the open space that they're using off the net acreage of the subdivision. So they're looking at the subdivision, taking out all the new proposed right-of-way for the subdivision, and then calculating the open space on there. We calculated it off gross acreage since I've been here. That's something that we've always done. However, looking at the regulations that we have, it does not really explain how you're supposed to calculate that, so kind of something that's open for interpretation. But with that, again, they're about 1.36 acres short when you do the gross acres. I didn't look at it with the net acreage, but I believe they exceed it pretty easily when you take out of all those right-of-way acres. So that'd be something that I think the applicant kind of make a case for the way they did it. We'll leave it up to the commission, I think, to decide if you want to use the gross, if you want to dedicate the more open space, or if you're fine with the open space. But again, as a reminder, and we did note this in the staff report, that we believe there's various methods of alternative compliance, but they do meet with this. So take that into consideration, I guess, when considering that particular requirement. Lastly, code requires that all development incorporate stormwater control strategies that better replicate natural watershed hydrology, water quality, and control runoff discharge volume, frequency, and quality. According to the applicant and the meetings that we've had with them, development will not require much grading at all of this site. Most of the site would drain towards outlets A and B through surface drainage and the proposed roadway ditches. Outlet A drains under Cindy Lane into outlet B that flows into a short tributary before reaching Squaw Creek, which is just a tad over 1,600 feet east of this site. So to Squaw Creek, again, not much of a distance from the Squaw Creek area. And this kind of shows the elevation on the site. What I did here is just kind of use some color coding on those elevations there. But you can see the low point obviously being here where it drains into that ditch, and then some of the high points being on the edge here. And if you just kind of follow the color code as it goes down, you can see for the most part the site drains into here, into this point as well right there. And when you look over here and you put all the roads in there, relatively what happens is that when you use the roadway ditches, you're going to see most of that flow go into those ditches. And with those ditches flowing in here, eventually that's all going to get it down into this outlot area right here and then drain into this point there. I'm not an expert at that, but again, when you see the elevation marks on the property there, it's pretty easy to kind of follow that. Looking at some of the comments from the Erie NT review team, what I will note is that through the previous 2-3 months or so, we've looked through a lot of proposals from a staff standpoint and through the interagency review team, looked at various proposals for this site. County Engineer Darren Moon did state that this proposal is preferred from a roads perspective, keeping all lot accesses south of Lot 19. The access drive for 2122 needs to be checked for site distance. I'm not sure if he's done that yet, but that's something that can be done as we move forward. And then the five new drives that come off of 505th Avenue, he did note that those will all need a driveway entrance permit from his office. And then Margaret James with Story County Environmental Health, she did note that she has informed the applicant that a soil evaluation for septic suitability is required for each lot. The developer must also cordon off the area recommended for the secondary treatment in order to keep construction traffic and stockpiles off the area. And again, talking, I think, with the engineer of the applicant, they do plan on getting out there at some point and doing a soils evaluation. That's something that needs to be done, though, once the ground thaws. Looking at comments from the general public, we did send out FPO letters on this one on December 30th, and legal notifications were published on January 2nd. And we did note that this property is not located in any floodplain. With that, your four alternatives are listed on the screen here above, and if there are any questions from the commission, I'd be happy to entertain at this time.
Probably there are a lot of irregularities and incomplete information here. Are we ready to go through with this tonight? Does this need to be tabled until all this? I mean, this is a lot.
Yeah, and to be honest, there's not many subdivision cases that we review where they don't have a few glaring items like this that come through. Ultimately, it's up to the commission how you want to go about it. I think from staff standpoint, I would view most of the omissions on there as somewhat minor. A lot of them, they can be fixed with when the engineer looks at the new plat. They can put those setback lines in there. They can put those public utility easements on there. And that's just more or less showing them on the plat. I'm not sure that's really going to change the perception of what's happening here. But again, a lot of that stuff can be changed in a matter of, you know, a half a day or so before it goes to the Board of Supervisors. The biggest thing for me is the public utility notification letters that we have not received. But at the same time, this area out here especially, I'm not sure that there's going to be anything that comes in that says that they can't provide service to those areas. And I believe if there was, we would have heard about it by now. So, but again, ultimately, it's up to the commission how you want to move forward on this.
Other commissioners have questions?
There is no indication in the land development regulations as to whether the open space requirement should be calculated on the gross versus net acreage. No indication at all.
And yeah, I'm looking at Leanne because I didn't really even realize this till today, and I asked her about it. And yeah, we don't have any indication on how that should be calculated. And I think that's something that we're going to definitely be making note of and making sure we get that fixed, because it's the first time that we've really run into it. But the way this subdivision, at least we got the alternative compliance, is almost what we kind of refer to sometimes as an administrative waiver. You do these things and we can lessen the requirements of some of these other things. So the good thing with this subdivision, when we initially started talking with the applicant, there was a lot of intention to use our RC, residential conservation overlay, on this to kind of create a conservation subdivision. There was one key holdup with the applicant on that one. There's one requirement that they couldn't meet, so they decided not to go with that particular overlay, but still at the same time they're meeting various aspects of the RC overlay, which in our opinion I think meets a lot of the requirements of the alternative compliance. So again, we don't necessarily define if we go by gross or net on that one, but at the same time, if we were to say gross, staff's comfortable in saying that there are a lot of alternative compliance measures that we could throw out there that we could almost give that administrative waiver of that particular requirement. You could say, no, we're going to go with net, and then we don't have to worry about it. So.
Well, it seems to me that, for the record, if we're going to make that change in the future, which we need to make, that I think it should be calculated on the net. We're already dedicating a lot of land area to the public's use here, so, you know, I don't know. So I don't know what the right percentage is, but I think it should be calculated on the net. And so I'd have no problem with that. But I am a little concerned about just the number of things that, in all likelihood, aren't going to make a big difference in the end. But if a couple of them are different than we expect, mm-hmm. it could make a big difference.
Yeah. And again, that's ultimately, I think, what the commission needs to do. Decide is if they're comfortable making a recommendation on this application tonight, or if they want that additional information before you make that recommendation. So,
I have a question about the roads. Is 550th, the road to the west, is that a gravel road currently? And 190th, those are both gravel roads currently.
Yep.
And with running the proposed, I guess, Sarah Lane and Cindy Lane to 550th. Is there any plan to pave 550th on that section, or are they going to leave that as gravel going to a paved road?
Yeah, it's been discussed. I know the applicant has had a few conversations with the board of supervisors on that as well. We don't have anything in concrete that says, yes, we're going to pave this at some point, but the discussion has taken place, and it's really all I can say, I guess, at this point, because I don't know where that'll ever go. I mean, funding's one thing on these projects. When you're paving a new road, funding's always the kind of thousand-pound gorilla, is how you're going to pay for it. And that needs to be decided, obviously, before we move forward with paving a road. But when you look at, and I didn't include it on this, but I probably should have in this presentation, but when you look at the land use plan, the Ames River Fringe plan out there, it actually does plan for residential further to the west as well, to up into that 2-mile limit of the city of Ames. So there is a lot of vacant farm ground out here that on the Ames River Fringe plan shows for future residential use. So if this area starts kind of growing out like the Fringe plan intends, at some point that road probably is going to need to be paved. But at that point, again, it's a matter of time and money.
The other question I had is about looking at the way that this is, the outlots are designed here. It looks like it funnels a lot of water to outlot B, into that tributary, into Squaw Creek. Since this is currently, you know, basically they're not going to need to grade it, but it's currently all farmland. If they put roads and I'm assuming some sort of, you know, water collection built into the roads and some sort of runoff plan for the housing, right, roofs and mm-hmm. downspouts and things, isn't that going to just by nature increase the flow in that tributary and then into Squaw Creek?
I would think so, yeah, and I think, again, as you mentioned, you're putting a lot of impervious surface into any subdivision when you're putting in your roads, and so, yeah, you're probably going to increase the amount of runoff that is happening. But, you know, with the use of outlots, that's one thing where you can kind of at least catch capture a lot of that drainage and hope that it infiltrates into the ground before it gets to that point. There's various ways you can do that too. You could add a lot of native vegetation, native plantings with deep roots and stuff that will collect a lot of that stuff. And I'm not sure if that's been necessarily proposed as something in the staff report we mentioned with covenants. Is you can almost discuss a lot of that stuff in the covenants and make decisions on that stuff in the covenants and how you're going to do that. And that's kind of something, once we do review the covenants, that we might recommend is how that those outlot areas are going to be maintained. The homeowners association is going to be responsible for it, but that's something that a lot of conservation subdivisions will use as kind of bioswales, and they'll use those deep root native plantings to kind of filtrate a lot of that water out of there.
Because in the last, I don't know how to say this other than the last couple of floods that have happened in Ames, that Squaw, the increasing flow because of, as you know, Northridge Heights, Cameron School Road, as all of these divisions that go around those tributaries in Squaw Creek increase the inflow, it causes more and more downstream problems. They're redoing in the south end of Northridge section. They're redoing the pond and the drain pipes because it completely floods an entire section of that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're adding, this is a large subdivision mm-hmm. that's potentially going to contribute to that runoff. I don't know what options are available to us other than voicing a concern that we're increasing runoff to something that's already an issue.
Close as it is to Squaw Creek. I mean, I'm on the Environmental Protection Commission, and we just approved a watershed management program for Squaw Creek, which is, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So here we're trying to address this, and now we're just increasing it because you have small landowners who all like to fertilize their lawns. And you're right, it's all going in one spot. So some kind of a biofilter there would be essential.
The other thing that I have is there, I don't know what changing this from an A1 to an AR, what does that do for, are there any restrictions then on livestock or, farm animals on the properties?
Yeah, the one thing with the state of Iowa when it comes to county zoning is the state of Iowa exempts agricultural uses from zoning. So realistically, if you have an R1, an R2, an AR, it's really hard to regulate agricultural uses. With covenants, usually a lot of times you'll see that regulated. And just kind of by general human thought, I guess I would say, when you're going from A1 to an AR, obviously when you're going to have 42 residential lots out there, I think it gives homeowners the feeling that, livestock's not allowed out here. So, but again, county zoning in Iowa, you've got that agricultural exemption. It's very broadly written in state code, so it can be interpreted in many different ways. But for the most part, I think we would say from an enforcement standpoint that, if one of the landowners puts some chickens in their backyard, there's really not much we can do about it because of that clause. But again, covenants are usually what is used to protect that. And I think, I apologize because I haven't had a chance to really look at the covenants yet, but I would assume that that's probably addressed in the covenants because most residential subdivisions of this nature, you'll see that addressed in the covenants. So.
I'm probably less concerned about chickens
mm-hmm.
than
yeah.
horses or cows
yeah.
or pigs.
Yeah, I would imagine they're all covered in the covenants. But the applicant will speak here shortly, too, and I think he'll probably be able to let you know that.
Go for the flag lot. Why don't you like flag lots, and what is a flag lot?
And this was kind of a discussion I had with the applicant this morning. It's not that we don't like flag lots. I think we recognize that they are useful in a lot of scenarios, but what we try to avoid, and I wish we had access to GIS here. I could show you one example of a subdivision where they used 4 or 5 flag lots to access the road, and it just, what happens is you have these long, narrow strips going down to the road and accessing lots in the back. And it's just something I think from a planning perspective that we don't like to see, because it almost kind of lets you develop lots back further and further and further just with the use of all these driveways coming down to a certain road, and it doesn't really give you a good feel. But, you know, this one in particular, it's there, and I'm not sure if it has something to do with the topography on those two lots or not. So it's not a huge deal from that that regulation that we have. I don't think it's a huge deal in this particular subdivision just because it is only one. But the reason we put that in there was just to avoid, again, all these flag lot subdivisions being created down to public roads. We did our subdivision regulation review last year. You may recall we had some new regulations that came through, and that was one thing. We used the interagency review team to kind of talk about some changes that need to be made. That was one thing in particular that I think there was about three or four departments commented on that we'd like to get away from doing, and the county engineer was one of them, especially just because it's really hard to permit all these driveways coming down onto a road, especially when you need that 300-foot space, and it gets really complicated to do that. So
frontage would be required in order for that to not be a flag lot by definition?
I didn't bring my regulations up. I know we have a lot width requirement in our zoning district, but the way that's measured is the average between the front and the back, so this technically would meet them, but it's the way that we define flag lot. And thank you, Kristen.
Maybe an easier question is, would it take how drastic a change to the lot?
Not that drastic. And again, it's just more or less to the point where it doesn't meet that definition anymore. And let me just get it here real quick. Okay. Lot flag means... Okay, a flag lot means a lot, parcel, or tract where the building area is situated behind another lot, parcel, or tract in which has a narrow frontage extended to a street or road. The term flag lot refers to the shape of the lot, parcel, or tract. So, again, that's where we looked at this one, is you have the building area kind of tucked behind Lot 8. So more or less, if you could, with that space that you have right there, if you could almost just, it's hard to, I guess, explain on here. But here, if you could take the lot line right here and almost just kind of create another lot line like that, that would almost do away with it, the flag lot. But it's just the way it's situated and creating that building area behind Lot 8 is where the problem runs in. So,
you are creating a situation, even though it's not a terribly flagrant violation,
you are
creating a situation where that a lot buyer has very few options for accessing their property, and should something happen, let's say erosion right there next to that draw.
Yeah. And that's a good point as well, too, yeah.
You've got 35 feet in which to put a driveway, and you're creating a lot that might cause a problem for a member of the public in the future that may not think about that.
And the one thing I will note again is the applicant and I kind of went over some of this stuff this morning, and I think his indication was that it wouldn't be a huge deal to rearrange that, and that they probably would do that. Again, I don't know. The problem is, I think their main engineer that worked on this isn't in the office right now, and the question was exactly why that was put on there, if it had something to do with topography and creating suitable building areas. I have no idea. So, but you can see if you go kind of to the northwest right there with those topography lines that you start kind of getting a sharp cutoff of topography down into that outlot. So that could be some of the reason why it was put in there. But
well, we've been in meeting for an hour and a half. Would anyone like a 3-minute break before we hear our applicant?
Certainly.
Yes. Just a 3-minute recess to be right back. Okay, our 3 minutes are up. I'll call the meeting back to order. Our applicant is present, and if so, would come to the podium and give your report. Again, please state your name and address.
Thank you, Commission. My name is Kurt Friedrich, 106th Street in Ames. And just want to wish everyone a Happy New Year as well. And thanks for coming out on a cold night. Typically, and I have just had an opportunity to review the staff comments here over the weekend. But it's very typical what I'm seeing here. There's always a few comments here related to our proposed plat that we need to work through. And as Charlie was stating here, I don't see really anything here in the comments provided by staff that we cannot quickly complete in a satisfactory manner. I want to address just a couple of main points and then be able to answer any questions. Aaron, you had mentioned going to net acres. On every subdivision that we've done in the last 20 years in Ames, we've based these calculations on net acres. So we pull out right-of-ways from the gross acres. And when you do that in this situation, you come up with approximately 56.14 acres. And then if you apply the 15% open space requirement to that net acreage, that's 8.44 acres, and we exceed that at 8.88 acres. And so that's how that calculation was made. And I would encourage the county to consider moving to that method of calculation as well. But as Charlie mentioned, there are, with the way that we've laid out our plat, which essentially is a conservation design, there are these other provisions called alternative compliance provisions that I'm sure that we would meet as well. So I think we'll be just fine with regard to that item. As far as drainage, that's a very important issue for us as well. I want to say we've reached out to the neighborhood, and I attended the Hickory Hills Executive Committee meeting here on December 10th and met with their group. And one of their main concerns is drainage. The other concern had to do with animals and use on the properties adjacent. And I'll first address the drainage. Charlie, can you go to the actual concept layout there? Maybe focus on that layout.
Okay. Let's see if I can get back to the better one here. Give me a second. Right there.
Perfect. As it's been mentioned, we're really not going to be doing a significant amount of grading. We don't want to disturb the natural drainage ways that currently exist within the farm. However, I will say that I'm confident that we'll be able to better manage the runoff than what currently exists on the property with our planned subdivision here. Essentially, the road that is proposed here as Cindy Lane that dissects the property here will essentially serve as a barricade in terms of holding water that is currently flowing to the northeast this direction and hold the water in this area. Now, on either side of this proposed lane, there is a 10-foot-wide ditch that would be depressed there And we will be grading to those ditches, obviously, on those adjacent lots. So there would be the ability to hold and contain water there and then allow it to soak into the ground. And the uses, as Commissioner Couser had noted, we will be using bioswales and native grasses in those areas to help with the absorption of water in those areas. But we will be able to, for the folks here at Hickory Hills, be able to improve the runoff situation from what currently exists through what we were just talking about here with Cindy Lane, as well as the green space here, these permanent green spaces. We will have the ability to shape these green spaces, which is what we plan to do, to slightly depress these green spaces here, again, to hold water for short periods of time. And then in this area in particular, there's a larger area where we will be able to hold. This would be a dry pond, not a permanent pond of any kind, but the attractive dry pond with, again, native grasses, but it would be depressed and have the ability to hold water that has run off. So we are not in a position now where we have a completed drainage plan and stormwater management plan, and we don't typically have that at this point in the game, but we would certainly prior to our final plat. So it's something that we're very sensitive to and important to us, and we plan to incorporate good stormwater management techniques here within the development. And then to the other points of concern for our neighbors, which had to do with animals and restricting uses and so forth, the best method for being able to control uses is within your restrictive covenant. And we have just now put together our first draft here of the restrictive covenant. And I would like to just go through a couple of points here within the covenant that, and there are several, I don't want to take too much of your time reading through our covenants here for your benefit, but I want to point out a couple of key areas that we discussed at the executive committee meeting with our neighbors. And this particular item here is in item 7C. It says, no detached buildings or other structures, including but not limited to garages, storage or utility buildings, sheds, windmills, or playhouses, shall be built on any lot without prior written consent of the developer or the committee being an architectural review committee. So this had to do with being able to protect, restrict the types of structures that are placed on the lot, and ultimately we would have control of that and have to approve whatever structures are built on the lot for the benefit of our members within our association, as well as the members of the Hickory Hills Association. Another item here, item 7O, no animals, poultry, or livestock of any kind, including but not limited to horses, shall be raised, bred, or kept on any lot, except that dogs, cats, and other common household pets may be kept so long as they are not kept, bred, or maintained for commercial purposes. Dogs must be tied, fenced, or kept in the dog run, or on a leash at all times. And in terms of stormwater management, any construction or earth moving on any lot shall be in compliance with all laws relating to stormwater discharge permitting. The lot owner shall be the sole responsible permittee for the lot with respect to compliance with the terms, provisions, and requirements of any NPDES
stormwater discharge permit number 2 and any stormwater pollution prevention plan that includes the lot. And then the covenants also then provide an enforcement mechanism. So it's really important that this is understood too, I think, is that covenants, again, they cover every lot owner, whereas a deed restriction would just cover a specific lot. And so that's where, when you want to make sure that you're protecting and restricting, covenants apply to everyone in the subdivision. And that way, if any member, frankly, any member or lot owner within the subdivision would note a violation to those covenants, that one individual, it only takes one individual to recognize the violation of someone within the development and can correct that situation for you. As far as the letters from the public utility companies, honestly, I believe that the only reason that we haven't received those yet is because of the crazy Christmas and holiday schedule that we've been on. We have verbally talked to many of these entities and know that the utilities are in our area or adjacent to our property and that they will be able to serve the area. So those letters will be forthcoming here in the very, very near term. I'd also like to point out here that we've worked very closely with Charlie and Leanne and the rest of the staff in terms of coming up with a plan that meets the requirements that are required here by Story County. We've gone through probably 15 different iterations of plans to come up with the plan that here is for you. We're very, very proud of this plan. I think it'll be a beautiful, beautiful neighborhood. And again, it does meet all the requirements that Story County has. As far as the flag lot condition, Charlie was correct. I think we can just make a simple lot line adjustment there. The reason that our engineer, Charlie stated that he wasn't available today, that's correct. He's still on vacation right now, so he would have been here tonight too to speak to this. But you notice that the elevation lines on that, on those two lots, are such that the pointer, there's more severe slopes in this area and in this area, while it's flatter here in the center. And so I'm sure the reason that Scott had designed this lot layout the way he had with these two lots was to be able to create a little larger building envelope for lot 9. Now, I think that we still could have a reasonable building envelope should we essentially split this area to the northeast. We may need to come a little further south with that, but because the slopes here look fairly severe, but I think we can probably eliminate that flag lot condition. And then with regard to lot 44, we're approximately 90 square feet short, I think, of the minimum requirement. We would just borrow the necessary square footage here from lot 43 in order to make sure that we are meeting the 1 acre minimum size requirement for the lot. And the other thing I wanted to point out too is that we didn't haphazardly pick this area for the development of the subdivision. There are very, very few areas within Story County that have a rural residential land use designation. Very, very few. And very, very few closer to Ames as well. And so that is why we have specifically shown interest in this property was because of that land use designation. And as Charlie mentioned here last month, following that land use designation, we applied for and the commission made a recommendation of approving the rezoning to be consistent with that land use designation from A1 to AR, and the supervisors will take first action on that tomorrow. While I agree there are some items here that need to be cleaned up, I think they are quite minor and can be dealt with very quickly. And now that we have our engineer back in town and we're in the office every day, I'm sure we'll be able to make these corrections and edits very quickly. So, are there any questions that I can answer?
Do you have any commissioners that have questions for Mr. Friedrich?
I just have a comment. Native grasses are really good at reducing erosion as well as flowing water down, but they are really difficult to establish. So it'll look good in about 5 years. It's going to take a while. It's going to be dependent upon the climate or the weather, I should say, in Iowa as the years you start putting them out. But I think it would look good once you can get it established and get the weeds, the invasive species you don't want there under control.
Good example of a conservation development that we've done just recently in Ames is the Ringenberg subdivision, Ringenberg Estate. And in that development, we have a large amount of open space and green space that we have cultivated some really nice native grasses, and it does take time. But we have to, and you have to manage it actively. And we have an individual.
You hit on part of my question there. I mean, how would you propose that you document to the Planning Commission and then onto the Board of Supervisors what exactly you intend for those areas, and then how can you give us some assurance that maintenance is going to be ongoing? You know, you can put it in your covenants, but your covenants have the potential for expiring after a certain amount of time, right? And they're enforced basically according to whatever will the property owners have for enforcing them. So do you have any mechanisms you recommend for making sure that they're planted the way you have in mind and that they are maintained that way? The association there has maintained the services
up on Thurman to continue the work that he started with us to, again, pick up a public person essentially that is responsible for ensuring the maintenance there in the top out here. So it would be our primary responsibility initially, and I would say probably for the first 5 or 6 years, and then that would gradually be shifted over to the property through the association. And yes, the association problems do last just for 21 years, and that's where a healthy association would take action to renew those covenants for the expiration of their 21 years.
The covenants that you submitted, the draft covenants, includes any specifics about what type of planting should be there and how they'll be maintained? You can kind of see where I'm going with this. How do we know that after 10 years, when you've sold the majority of the lots and this turns over to the homeowners association, that's not planted for soccer fields?
Sure.
You know? Charlie, this is going to go back a ways, but do you know what mechanism was used in the Cameron Pines subdivision where they established a native plant buffer specifically to filter water, to filter runoff, and it's just kitty corner from here? No shock about that.
I think it was a combination of a couple of commercials that I recall. One of the conditions of approval and rezoning that went forward with the subdivision was that the type of planting be determined hand in hand with short-term conservation. So that the appropriate, and that was a condition of approval. If I remember correctly, I'm both the rezoning and ultimately the final subdivision of that. Those are then all out that, but one large or maybe one or two larger outlines. And I do believe that further the covenant. But I'm very certain saying the type of planning here that was defined in question about that. So for the conservation draft out that
time. County Conservation had no comments or concerns on this plat that I could tell. Okay. Thanks.
Is there anyone else here who would like to come to the podium and speak to this agenda item? And once again, please state your name and address.
Our plan to begin this meeting around 5:30. already. The goals of that PowerPoint right from the get-go were for your agriculture. She's developed it responsibly. Do whatever it takes to make sure that when you do develop an agriculture, it is classified extensively and is worked out thoroughly, and has everybody's intention put the best way forward, not just to create a place for somebody to have a house and raise their family. I've sat and listened to Charlie and his creator with their intentions, with their assumptions of what has come now, why it's coming now, with how they think buffers will work and the range, how it shouldn't be a big concern because the dishes can put in place, they're going to absorb a lot of water. There are holes in things that seem in this project as of right now, and Mr. Friedrich says that they've looked good. Develop this over a period of 3 to 5 years. That being the case, I don't see what the rush is for you guys to make a decision to approve this tonight with these missing parts of their plan that are not meeting certain requirements. There's lot sizes, kind of viewing, and there's one that's not much to be redesigned and looking for. Not just you, but the neighbors who are concerned. Common area, which indicates to be a certain size required by county, and that is on that as well. These are items that are things that we can probably get the picture real quickly, and we're assuming that folks will be back in town tomorrow, and we can get the change, and we're going to do this, but legally and responsibly, the Planning and Zoning Commission, I feel, should hold these future layout and development to the standards which the development plan of Story County was set up for, to have all your ducks in a row, to have everything taken care of, to make sure that your watershed is protected. I've been in my house for 5 years, and twice I've seen 190th Street. Just to the east of my place in this valley here, be under 10 feet of water. That whole entire floodplain is 10 feet under. The road has been washed out twice. And there's not a whole lot of water that is collected north of 190th Street, I'm sorry. It's just a couple of farms that trickle in there that starts that Squaw Creek, really, within a matter of 2 or 3 months. And the additional drainage, no matter where it's coming from, is it needs to be regulated. And as you saw with the contour drawings of the property, I would say that it's safe to say 60-70% of this development all drains to that one area. And as you can see with the yellow and the orange, everything basically on the north and the east side of that whole development, almost right down the middle, all flows into that one drainage area. And this summer we had extremely dry after the month of May. June, July, August, we didn't have hardly any rain. Water still flows through that drainage down into that floodplain. I walk here with my dog regularly. Now, granted, there's a lot of tiling in that field, but, I don't see how it can be any better when you put in 47 houses with roofs that are shedding water through the gutters and down onto the yard and the driveways and the blacktop and that sort of thing. Conservation is a very big thing for me, and responsible development is an extremely big thing for me. I don't mind seeing development. I didn't intend for the area to be developed when I first bought this place 5 years ago. I worked very hard for a long time to save my money to have a place that was close to Ames, but was a piece of
Mother Earth, I guess, with being floodplain and trees and deer and that sort of thing, development is going to happen. On top of this 60 acres out of purchase, or 66, whatever it is, you know, there's other developments, I believe, or acres to the west of that that were purchased as well. And I'm assuming it's just going to be a matter of time before Ames needs more places to grow. However, those places to the west are not going to be directly shedding water into a major watershed and are going to be able to be graded and developed responsibly based on the fact that they're primarily flat for the most part, whereas there's some major contours in this particular parcel that they won't start on. I just would like the zoning board to hold their development to the standards that was put in place by Story County Development Plan and make sure that everything is being done responsibly and in the best intentions. It's not just a few people that are going to own a lot here, but people that live around it that will have to deal with some of the things that come with it. You know, I love the fact that there's only 80 cars, according to this, that go down my road each day. It surprised me when I heard that number. I knew it was a lot because there's only 6 houses on this road. So most of the people that are using this road right now use it as a cut through from Cameron School Road to George Washington Carver. And it's bothersome because there is no speed limit there. There's a very high amount of vehicles that lean over the top of the hill, ride within a blind drive, and they're doing 50 or 60 miles an hour. And, you know, traffic is going to increase on that road when we have this development. I just want to make sure that whatever is being done is being done responsibly, because I care about my house, I care about my neighborhood, I care about my daughter's future at the house, most importantly. So, I don't really have questions, I just have concerns about how things are being done and that what loose ends are being presented and are being, you know, these are assumptions and, you know, we'll take care of it and that sort of thing. I don't see the rush. I want these things taken care of. I want all the ducks in a row. I want this to be done responsibly. I want Freedom Realty and Construction to uphold everything that they say about being responsible and neighborly and building
Thank you for your comments. Is there anyone else who would like to speak?
All that farm field water underneath the Green Hills Drive
and then above my yard and basically watch it go right away. And, you know, another drug use confirms the Kurt and Brad, and basically, I think I agree with what they stated with the road coming through to maybe act as a barrier to reduce some of the runoff. Sort of the addition of the bio green spaces there along the Victory Hills Drive and other areas could, in fact, still reduce the amount of runoff coming to the neighborhood. So in that respect, I think there's just some benefits for us. So I just want to see, as a neighbor, saying, yeah, as developers, they've been good neighbors in reaching out to us.
Thank you for your comments. I assume there's no other public comment to this issue. So public comment will now close. Are there any additional questions for staff or the applicant?
I have a question for Mr. Friedrich. Could you speak to the hardships that you would bear if we did delay this for a month?
I have one more question for you. You don't need to sit down again. The question, I still am concerned with the water runoff in the area, and I know that you've addressed that somewhat with the street being a divider and building in some of the dishes and things like that, which is great for what I would say is usual or annual or incidental precipitation. But in heavy rains and things, those fill up and drain, and that doesn't really do as much for the total runoff and heavy rains. Is there a plan, or is there anything that based on Mr. Royson, is that on his comments about the farm tile, is there any plans or anything to be done with the existing farm tile? Is it just going to be left as is and then you build on top of it, or is there any type of disruption or removal of any parts of the existing farm tile that happens during any of the development?
Are no further questions.
I do have another one. With the flag lot, if the engineer decides that there's not enough building space to eliminate the little flag portion or whatever, will you sacrifice that lot, or what happens then?
Yeah, and real quick regarding the flag lot, as Kurt had mentioned, we don't prohibit flag lots. We just say they shall be avoided wherever possible. So if there's some commentary that at least can be filed away with the subdivision request that shows that we need to have this flag right here, we really don't have a choice in the matter. This is why. I think at that point we'd be okay with that. The problem is right now we don't have that commentary, so we're not sure why that flag lot's there, but just like I said, from the naked eye, when you look at it, it seems that it can be adjusted, but when you start throwing topography in there, maybe it's not able to, and again, we just want commentary to back that up, if that's the reason why.
Another concern I have about that specific location, not just that it's the flag lot, but the little portion that gives that lot access to the road is on the slope,
mm-hmm.
and in the flooding situation, I don't know that they would be able to get their vehicles in and out.
Yeah, and and I think Aaron brought that up too, just with the very narrow band right there too, that you're very limited to where you can access the lot, and that can be an issue as well too. So
I would just say that we are certainly not sick on this layout. I'm not going to trust that we absolutely have to have this layout, and I'm certainly open to having the discussion between now and approval of the final plat with staff. If we need to go to a more conventional layout for these lots, like we had shown, we're happy to do that.
Question? Margaret James pointed out that a soils analysis will need to be done to find the appropriate sites for septic. When is that typically done, at preliminary plat stage? Or
it's actually a new requirement that we implemented just this year, so we haven't had too much of a experience with it. I know with, why can't I think of the subdivision that just went in, Bella Woods. I think they did that, Bella Woods did that prior to the final plat coming forward. One of the different things with Bella Woods we had was we approved the preliminary plat, they put the improvements in, and then brought the final plat forward. What we've always done when there's improvements warranted is we'll approve the preliminary plat. Before we approve the final plat, there needs to be a development agreement in place that shows how they're going to do that, and then bond for the improvements as well. Or they put the improvements in and then bring the final plat forward. So I know that we've dealt with both these in the past. What we did with Bella Woods was we recommended from a staff standpoint that they include the soils analysis in the development agreement, because that's typically how we've been used to those coming forward. You have preliminary plat, then final plat approval alongside with the development agreement. We didn't get the development agreement with that one, but again, that particular developer worked with Margaret pretty well, I think, in getting that analysis done prior to the final plat.
Are likely areas for drainage fields required to be put on the final plat? Are they physically supposed to be shown on the
plat? No, not on the final plat. Again, there's just the final plat, I think, does require that the soil analysis be done and given to Margaret, in this particular case, the director of the health department, and just more or less assurances from her that everything's good to go.
Last question. You mentioned development agreements for improvements. Could not the plantings, the biosphere, that sort of thing be considered?
Yeah, and I was going to
include it in the development agreement.
Looking at staff report, I'm not sure what page it's on. It should be towards the back, though. There's a section 88.14 that goes over development agreements, and I think I did include that in the staff report. But, yeah, that's something that can all be covered in that. And, again, that bonding can be brought forward to make sure that gets done. You know, heaven helps that Kurt puts that – Kurt develop subdivision, something happens, and he sells off the land and somebody else takes it over, just assurances that that's going to be done, some bonding money put forward in case the county needs to do it themselves. You know, what you mentioned with the homeowners association, I think that's kind of a reoccurring theme that we deal with. I know with cities, some of these open spaces sometimes can be directed to the Parks and Recreation Department of the city, and well, the county is not going to take ownership of any of these outlots. It's just been a long-standing policy that we've had, and that's unfortunate in that sense because it's hard to control at that point when you're relying on a homeowners association. But again, that development agreement, at least we can get it off and running. It's just maintenance past that, kind of up in the air. The
difference, though, is that with a street, for example, we know what streets we are going to be including in the development agreement and bonding for. We don't at this point know what improvements to drainage filters, bioswales, that sort of thing are going to happen because they haven't been proposed with any specificity. And so just moving forward, that's something I feel like, even if it's just a letter, I would feel more comfortable knowing what's actually proposed for those common areas. That's not a question. Sorry.
Yeah, I know.
Well, we've spent a lot of time discussing this. Perhaps it's time to either make a motion to move forward or table it, and that decision, it's time to make that decision now. So I would entertain some help.
I personally think that there are just too many loose ends. I think we've talked about that we have verbalized that there are probably satisfactory solutions in the offing, but there are just too many of them for me to really keep track of. And so I would move that we do alternative four, the Historic County Planning and Zoning Commission table, the major division preliminary plat is put forth in case sub 12-13 back to the applicant and or staff for further review and or modification.
Do I have a second on that motion?
I second that.
Question? Roll call.
Donaldson?
Yes. Couser?
Yes.
Steele?
Yes.
Wendt?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Brothers?
Yes.
The motion carries. This will be tabled. Frustrating for us and for you. We'll move forward. 9.2, discussion of rescheduling the June and November commission meetings. I remember it's election and they're trying to get set up and it just doesn't work out for us to. Do I hear a motion to amend
I would move that we change our meeting dates in June from the 2nd to the 5th and in November from the 3rd to the 6th at the same start time at 5:30 p.m.
Do I have to do roll call on that one? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. 9.3 long range planning update. Point 4, follow up on items recommended to the Board of Supervisors and the Board of Adjustment. Thank you.
And any commission comments, anything? I was negligent in not welcoming you to the commission, and certainly...
It wasn't on the agenda.
Well, appreciate your willingness to serve, and she's right, it'll be wonderful to have a fully staffed commission. We want to introduce ourselves, or would you like to share a little bit about who you are and where you come from? And Scott, we'll start with you.
I'm Scott Wendt. I live at Lincoln Highway, right across from an ethanol plant. And I was born and raised in Iowa. I work at ISU, and I've become interested in this with the wind farm that is being built. And I kind of got involved in the process of seeing that and reviewing the application. And as an engineer, I'm interested in engineering analysis. And there wasn't any engineering analysis to view for this meeting, but maybe next one.
Dave Struthers. I live east of Collins, where I farm, raising hogs and corn, soybeans, the general crops. I have a few cattle, too. And I'm the tenured member, but not necessarily the most knowledgeable member of the committee. And I made the faux pas last month of talking about being surrounded by women, if I could handle that, you know, on the commission, that I see they filled the spots with all males, so maybe I could control myself a little more, right, Kirsten? And unfortunately, she put everything in the minutes.
Well, I'm Nancy Calderon. We farm north in Nevada and have a large cattle feedlot. And I've been on, 2 years now?
I'm Susan Donaldson. I live 6 miles north of Nevada on a farm. And it's third generation farm. I'm pleased with that. I grew up in Ames, actually. So one of the things I feel like I bring is both an urban and a rural.
Marvin Smith. I've lived in Ames. I live in northwest Ames, and been there for almost 9 years. I grew up in Southern California, and I've lived in Arizona and Northern California, and so I've been much more of an urban. And I work in IT at Scan Fox. As Scott mentioned, I was brought to this. I was involved, attended, participated in some proposed rezoning and incorporation as part of the Ames urban fringe planning and things of some land right there across from where I live, and got me interested in thinking, you know, we're building that new fairway, and just questions about traffic and what they were doing, and really not having any information. It was frustrating. So I work with Wendy Darrell, who was previously on the commission, and so that got me interested.
How long have you been in Iowa?
Almost 9 years.
Okay. Didn't know if the deep freeze was killing you, or you're used to it now.
We've moved several times. We moved from Southern California, where there's no weather, to Arizona, which our family affectionately refers to as our time where we lived on the face of the sun, and Northern California, where we were in, you know, we had freezes and snow and things, and then I actually spent a few months in Germany, and so I mean, I'm Mormon, and I served a mission in Ohio, so in my youth, I lived a couple of years in, you know, the Greater Miami Valley wind tunnel, and I've been in the Midwest in cold and stuff, and chose to come back to it.
I'm Aaron Steele. I live northeast of Ames on an acreage where we raise a few beet goats, but otherwise we're kind of urban transplants. I work for a trade association doing marketing and promotion and outreach. And before that, though, I worked in the land department for 4 or 5 years. And just got done serving a year on the Board of Adjustment, but I wanted to be on the commission, so I switched over.
Any staff comments?
announcement of our future meeting. So that's February. February 3rd. Move to adjourn.
So moved.